When Jonathan Kellerman's When the Bow Breaks hit bookstores in 1985, it didn't just launch the now iconic Alex Delaware series, it redefined the psychological thriller genre. This debut novel, which won the Edgar Allan Poe Award, introduced readers to a protagonist who would become one of crime fiction's most enduring characters, Dr. Alex Delaware, a brilliant child psychologist with a knack for unraveling the most disturbing criminal minds. The book became an instant bestseller, praised by Stephen King as a terrific psychological thriller and launching Kellerman's career as a master of psychological suspense. What makes this novel particularly compelling is Kellerman's authentic portrayal of psychology, drawing from his own distinguished career as a clinical psychologist specializing in trauma. This seamless blend of professional expertise and storytelling prowess creates a chilling exploration of evil that continues to captivate readers nearly four decades later. Dr. Alex Delaware is enjoying his early retirement in his hillside home above Bel Air when his doorbell rings, shattering his peaceful existence. His visitor is Milo Sturgis, a police detective friend who needs a professional favor. A psychiatrist named Morton Handler and his female companion have been brutally murdered, their bodies mutilated in Handler's Pacific Palisades apartment. The only potential witness is 7-year-old Melody Quinn, a traumatized child who lives in the building and may have glimpsed shadows or heard voices of multiple men. Despite initial reluctance and references to a past traumatic case involving someone named Hickel, Delaware agrees to help interview the child. This decision pulls him back into the world he thought he'd left behind, a world of damaged psyches and unspeakable crimes. Delaware's character is immediately established as complex and contradictory. A brilliant professional who burned out spectacularly, yet can't resist the pull of a case involving a vulnerable child. The setting, luxurious Los Angeles homes juxtaposed with scenes of brutal violence, creates an atmosphere of deceptive tranquility. Kellerman masterfully establishes the contrast between Delaware's peaceful retirement and the horror he's about to confront. This opening establishes the central tension that will drive the narrative. Delaware's desire to protect himself from burnout versus his compulsion to help those who cannot help themselves, particularly children. Delaware's path to early retirement reveals much about his character. A prodigy who earned his PhD in clinical psychology at 24, he quickly rose to become an associate professor and program director at Western Pediatric Medical Center by 28. His success extended beyond academia into private practice and real estate investments, creating a life of nonstop achievement and exhaustion. By 32, Delaware was living an unsustainable regimen. 70-hour work weeks split between hospital duties and private patients, barely time to eat or sleep, growing a beard simply to save time shaving. His romantic life consisted of meaningless liaisons with coworkers. Despite occasional breathing difficulties he ignored, he pushed forward relentlessly until Stuart Hickel, a quiet, retired lab technician who looked like the kindly neighbor on a situation comedy, entered his life. Hickel's suicide in Delaware's home triggered dramatic life changes. Delaware resigned from Western Pediatric, closed his practice, sold his investment properties, and embraced a simpler existence focused on personal pleasures, playing his Martin guitar, listening to records, reading for enjoyment. He shaved his beard, got a tan, started dating, and met Robin, who improved his life further. This early retirement before his 33rd birthday was Be Kind to Alex time, a necessary healing period after the traumatic Hickel incident. This backstory establishes Delaware as someone who has experienced professional trauma firsthand, making his reluctance to get involved with the Handler case understandable. Yet it also reveals his compassion and dedication to helping children, setting up the internal conflict that will drive his character throughout the investigation. The Hickel incident looms as a mysterious shadow from the past, suggesting that Delaware's retirement wasn't merely about burnout, but something more sinister, a thread that will eventually connect to the current murders in ways he cannot yet imagine. Delaware's first meeting with Melody Quinn reveals both his professional expertise and the emotional core that drives him. The child is withdrawn and thumb-sucking, small for her 7 years, with a grave face and oversized brown eyes. Her blonde hair is held with plastic barrettes, and she wears jeans and a striped t-shirt. An ordinary child in extraordinary circumstances. The Quinn apartment is tiny, an architect's postscript of barely 400 square feet with sparse furnishings. Melody's mother, Mrs. Quinn, presents as a woman with pale, fragile-looking skin, plucked eyebrows, thin lips, and an underbite. Her wary demeanor suggests someone accustomed to mistreatment, and her cold, moist handshake reveals her anxiety about the situation. Delaware approaches Melody with gentle expertise, explaining he's a psychologist who helps children who are scared. In her tiny bedroom, shared with her mother and resembling a dungeon, Melody shows him her toys, including a grimy plastic doll named Amanda and a large turquoise stuffed walrus called Fatso, a gift from her father that her mother wants to discard. Her defensive response to praise reveals a child unaccustomed to compliments. When Delaware explains to Mrs. Quinn that he needs to build trust before attempting hypnosis, she seems exasperated but agrees to his return visit. After getting her permission to consult with Melody's doctor about taking her off medication, Delaware leaves, telling Milo, "You hooked me with the case. Those big, keen painting eyes got to me." This scene establishes several important elements: Melody's vulnerability and the possibility that she witnessed something traumatic, Mrs. Quinn's ambiguous role as either protective mother or potential obstacle, and Delaware's emotional investment in helping this child despite his professional reservations. The mention of medication raises questions about why a 7-year-old is being drugged, suggesting deeper issues that may connect to the murders. The stuffed walrus Fatso and the relationship with her absent father also plant seeds that will grow into crucial plot elements later in the story. Delaware's meeting with Dr. Tao, Melody's physician, reveals a disturbing undercurrent in the medical establishment. Tao's office is located in a stark 1950s tan brick building, but inside is a jarring contrast: a waiting room crammed with colonial maple furniture, needlepoint homilies, and cutesy prints of children. The space is packed with patients and smells of dirty diapers, suggesting an overbooked practice, more focused on volume than quality care. Tao himself is tall, lean, and strikingly handsome, with chiseled features, snow-white hair, and twinkling blue eyes, the picture of medical authority. His office displays numerous diplomas and photographs of himself with dignitaries, creating an atmosphere of self-congratulation. Among this display hangs one exception: a faded color photo of a pretty young woman holding a beautiful blonde boy in a sailor suit, a personal touch that will later prove significant. When Delaware requests that Melody be taken off Ritalin to facilitate hypnosis, Tao resists, saying he didn't like to tamper with a winning combination. He defends his prescription of 60 milligrams by reading from her chart: complaints of behavioral problems, poor attention span, striking her mother, and few friends. Delaware recognizes these as normal childhood behaviors, particularly the argument about giving away Fatso, the stuffed walrus gift from her father. Tao's lecture reveals his disturbing worldview, describing Melody as a victim of inferior genes from limited parents, poverty, and a broken home. He insists medication is her only hope to overcome these disadvantages, dismissing psychotherapy or behavior modification as impossible with her mother's limited capabilities. His condescending speech about medicating the Untermenschen to make them good citizens strikes Delaware as pseudo-scientific fascism, though he holds his tongue to maintain the charade of professional courtesy. This encounter establishes Tao as a figure who uses medical authority to control rather than heal, raising questions about his motives in keeping Melody medicated. His dismissive attitude toward lower socioeconomic classes reveals a classist worldview that will later connect to the broader conspiracy. The photograph of the woman and child hints at a personal history that may drive his current behavior. Most importantly, this scene establishes the theme of institutional power being used against the vulnerable, a central motif in the unfolding mystery. Delaware takes Melody to a park overlooking Pacific Coast Highway in Santa Monica, where they walk hand in hand along the outer rim, talking little. When he asks if she's ever been on a merry-go-round, she mentions a school trip to Magic Mountain. They head to the nearly deserted pier where Delaware pays the operator to keep the carousel going. As the Blue Danube waltz plays, Melody gradually relaxes, eventually swaying with the music, eyes closed in silent laughter, a rare moment of childhood joy. A young fisherman notices Melody staring at fish and jokes about the grossness, telling her that her daddy should take her to prettier places. Melody just smiles, not correcting his assumption. When Delaware asks if she's hungry, she admits she's kind of hungry, but seems worried about being too grabby, as her mother had warned. When asked what she'd had for breakfast, she reveals only juice and a piece of powdered donut, suggesting possible neglect. As noon approaches, when she would normally take her second dose of amphetamine, Delaware notices a remarkable change in her behavior. She becomes more animated, alert, and fidgety, as if waking from a long sleep. She points excitedly at surfers, comparing them to seals, and asks to go in the water. With every passing moment, her coordination improves until she moves like a gazelle, whooping and splashing until they're both breathless, revealing the vibrant child beneath the medication. Back at their picnic spot, she anxiously asks if she'd been a good girl, revealing her uncertainty about her own behavior. When Delaware assures her she is always good, even when others think she's done something wrong, she admits to getting mixed up. This conversation reveals the psychological impact of being medicated. Melody has internalized the idea that her natural behavior is somehow bad. When she mentions that her mother said Delaware was going to hypnotize her, he explains it isn't to make her think better, but to help her remember something about when the other doctor was hurt. Though she'd told police she remembered nothing, Delaware gently suggests hypnosis might help. On the empty beach, he conducts a brief hypnosis session, but despite his careful guidance, Melody can only see dark when asked about the night of the murder. After hypnosis, Melody asks if the technique could help her remember her father, whom she's never seen. He left when she was a baby and lives far away, though he occasionally sends gifts like her stuffed animal Fatso. She shows Delaware a carved, shrunken head with rhinestone eyes that she treasures and produces a worn snapshot showing her mother as a younger woman with a strange-looking man. One side of his face and body sags with hints of atrophy, making him appear crooked and asymmetrical. Despite this, he is tall and slender with long blonde hair and a thick mustache. This day with Melody establishes several crucial elements. The dramatic difference in her behavior off medication, suggesting she's being unnecessarily drugged. Her anxiety about pleasing adults and being good. Her connection to her absent father, despite never having met him. And most importantly, her inability to consciously recall what happened the night of the murder. The photograph of her father with his distinctive physical appearance plants a clue that will later connect to the broader conspiracy. While the mention of dark during hypnosis suggests she did witness something that night, even if she can't yet access the memory. Delaware receives a frantic 3 a.m. call from Milo Melody, has woken up screaming for her father. When Delaware arrives at the apartment, he finds Melody sitting upright in bed, rigid, with eyes wide open but unfocused. Bonita sits beside her, while Toll stands on the other side. The child is sobbing animal-like sounds that gradually build into piercing screams of, "Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!" Her hair is plastered to her face with sweat, and she flails against her mother's attempts to hold her. When Delaware approaches, Bonita immediately objects, blaming him for causing the problems. As tensions escalate, Bonita grabs her daughter, putting her hand over the child's mouth and shaking her, a dangerous reaction that both Toll and Delaware move to stop. Delaware approaches Melody and speaks soothingly. His calm, rhythmic speech gradually calms her down. He helps her lie down, continuing to talk reassuringly until her breathing slows and her muscles relax. She curls into a fetal position, thumb in mouth. As he kisses her cheek goodnight, she mumbles, "Dada." Outside the room, Toll confronts Delaware, saying, "I hope you're happy," and threatening to report him to the ethics committee. They argue bitterly. Delaware accuses him of turning children into drowsy little zombies with his medication, and reveals Toll's condescending comments about Benita's piss-poor protoplasm and bad genes. Benita interrupts their confrontation, insisting she doesn't want Delaware around anymore. She breaks down crying about losing her apartment due to the noise, while Toll comforts her. She can't understand why Melody keeps crying for her father, who had never supported them. In a shocking revelation, Benita reveals an ugly scar on her scalp, a thick, raw red mark with livid, lumpy skin showing bad surgery. "He did that to me, with a chain," she cries, explaining that Ronnie Lee Quinn, Melody's father, was a crazy, evil bastard, the daddy her daughter is crying for. Delaware approaches Melody and speaks soothingly. His calm, rhythmic speech gradually calms her down. He helps her lie down, continuing to talk reassuringly until her breathing slows and her muscles relax. She curls into a fetal position, thumb in mouth. As he kisses her cheek goodnight, she mumbles, "Dada." Outside the room, Toll confronts Delaware, saying, "I hope you're happy," and threatening to report him to the ethics committee. They argue bitterly. Delaware accuses him of turning children into drowsy little zombies with his medication, and reveals Toll's condescending comments about Benita's piss-poor protoplasm and bad genes. Benita interrupts their confrontation, insisting she doesn't want Delaware around anymore. She breaks down crying about losing her apartment due to the noise, while Toll comforts her. She can't understand why Melody keeps crying for her father, who had never supported them. In a shocking revelation, Benita reveals an ugly scar on her scalp, a thick, raw red mark with livid, lumpy skin showing bad surgery. "He did that to me, with a chain," she cries, explaining that Ronnie Lee Quinn, Melody's father, was a crazy, evil bastard, the daddy her daughter is crying for. This dramatic scene reveals several crucial developments. Melody's night terrors suggest her subconscious is processing trauma she witnessed. Her calls for daddy connect to the murder in ways not yet clear. Benita's violent history with Melody's father adds a new dimension to the mystery. And the professional conflict between Delaware and Toll escalates to open hostility. The revelation about Ronnie Lee Quinn's violence suggests a possible connection to the murders, while Benita's reaction raises questions about her own role in the unfolding drama. Most importantly, this scene establishes that Melody's hypnosis session has triggered something deeply buried in her psyche, something connected to her father and the night of the murder. Delaware begins investigating Morton Handler's patient files, which Milo brings to his house in cardboard cartons sealed with LAPD tape. After signing a waiver and receiving an official LAPD identification badge naming him special consultant, Delaware reviews the files of 600 male patients, focusing on those who might be capable of violent crime. The files reveal a disturbing picture of Handler as a psychiatrist. His therapy notes are sketchy, careless, and meaningless, especially in his final years. Financial records, however, are meticulously detailed with high fees and strongly worded letters to debtors. Though not over-prescribing medication, Handler had clearly burned out on his profession. His notes contain sarcastic put-downs of patients, showing contempt for the very people who trusted him. Yet he continued practicing, unwilling to sacrifice his six-figure income despite no longer caring about his work. 9 files particularly catch Delaware's attention, men between 16 and 32 diagnosed as psychopathic character disorders. Most were agency referrals with criminal histories, including 3 judged violent for assaults ranging from beating a parent to stabbing a classmate. None stayed in therapy long, unsurprising since psychotherapy offers little to those without conscience or desire to change. One particularly disturbing case was an 11-year-old raised by his baffled grandmother who insisted he was a good boy. When Delaware had asked if the boy remembered his mother, he leered and called her a real piece of ass based on photos he'd seen. Each layer revealed more rot. He was irredeemably bad and likely to get worse. Delaware also discovers that at the time of his murder, Handler had been making numerous phone calls to a patient named Maurice Bruno, a salesman with psychopathic tendencies. When Bruno is found murdered in his home, the connection between the cases becomes clear. Handler and Bruno weren't just doctor and patient, but likely partners in crime, two predators who recognized each other's potential usefulness. This investigation reveals the darker side of Handler's practice, not just a burned-out psychiatrist, but someone who may have been exploiting his position for criminal purposes. The discovery of Bruno's body with similar timing to Handler's murder suggests a connection between the killings, pointing to a broader conspiracy rather than isolated incidents. Most importantly, it establishes that Handler himself may have been engaged in criminal activity, making his murder less random and more targeted, a crucial shift in understanding the case. Delaware's investigation leads him to La Casa de los Niños, a residential institution for unwanted children founded by Reverend Augustus McCaffrey. The facility serves as a refuge for abused and neglected kids, orphans, runaways, and status offenders, typically housing children nobody wants, those with physical and psychological problems, older children unattractive to adoptive parents, and children of incarcerated women. On the surface, La Casa appears idyllic, 20 acres in Malibu on a 99-year lease with token rent, clean facilities in a nice area, in-house teaching with public school busing for special needs, and strong community involvement. The administration building is impressive, and the grounds are well maintained, with an animal area featuring chickens, goats, and hamsters. However, disturbing elements emerge during Delaware's tour. The cafeteria scene reveals children with cerebral palsy struggling to eat without assistance, spilling food, as counselors offer only verbal encouragement rather than helping them. Tim Krueger, the counselor giving the tour, describes the Gentleman's Brigade, successful corporate men who provide stable male role models by taking children to events and their homes. When Delaware questions whether exposing disadvantaged children to unattainable lifestyles might be frustrating, Krueger counters with rehearsed optimism about teaching children that only lack of motivation limits them. Most disturbing are four windowless bunker-like structures with sloping ramps to iron doors near the forest. When asked, Krueger dismissively calls them storage before hurrying back to the administration building. Later, Delaware witnesses a troubling scene, a child named Rodney being carried by two staff members, his feet dangling as he struggles like a trapped ferret, with one staff member clamping his hand over the boy's mouth as the child fights and screams. Delaware's meeting with Reverend Augustus McCaffrey reveals a man of imposing physical presence, 6.5 feet tall and weighing well over 300 pounds, with a pear-shaped mountain of pale flesh, hands like twin sandbags, and feet in Oxfords the size of small sailboats. Despite his massive size, his voice is surprisingly gentle and lyrical, softened by the lazy cadence of the Deep South. McCaffrey portrays La Casa as transforming children from mere statistics into individuals with souls and potential, proudly claiming miracles happening every day. Incontinent children learning control, retarded children learning to read, all while maintaining a self-satisfied, martyred demeanor. His office walls display connections to powerful figures, county supervisors, judges, the mayor, and many physicians, including Dr. Tao. This investigation of La Casa reveals the central tension between appearance and reality that drives the mystery. On the surface, the institution appears to be doing good work for vulnerable children, but disturbing elements suggest something sinister beneath the benevolent facade. The Gentleman's Brigade raises questions about who has access to these vulnerable children and for what purpose, while the mysterious bunker-like structures and the incident with the struggling child suggest potential abuse. Most importantly, the connection between McCaffrey, Tao, and other powerful figures begins to hint at a conspiracy involving the exploitation of vulnerable children, a conspiracy that may connect to Handler's murder and Melody's trauma. As Delaware's investigation deepens, he uncovers a web of connections between seemingly unrelated individuals. He discovers that Timothy Krueger, the counselor at La Casa, had lied about his credentials, claiming a master's degree in counseling when he actually had only a bachelor's in dramatic arts. More disturbing, Krueger had a violent past, having killed a fellow student named Jeffrey Saxon in college during a wrestling match that was ruled an accident despite evidence suggesting otherwise. Delaware also learns that Dr. Towell, Judge Edwin Hayden, and Stuart Hickle, the man whose suicide had driven Delaware into early retirement, had all grown up together on Brindamore Island, an exclusive enclave housing 200 wealthy families. They were nicknamed the Three Heads of State in college, and despite not seeming to enjoy each other's company, remained connected throughout their lives. The most shocking revelation comes when Delaware discovers that McCaffrey had once worked as a janitor for the Hickle family on Brindamore Island, later becoming a janitor at Jedson College, where Towell, Hayden, and Hickle attended. This connection suggests a power dynamic that would later be inverted, with McCaffrey using knowledge gained as a servant to control his former employer's sons. Delaware's investigation leads him to Kim Hickle, Stuart's widow, who reveals that her husband didn't commit suicide as the official verdict claimed. Despite his initial depression after arrest, he had bounced back and was making plans for their future, suggesting they move to Seattle and reclaim the family mansion. She believes Stuart was murdered by the others, his so-called friends, to prevent him from exposing them. Kim describes how these men would pick Stuart up in their big soft cars, wearing sport jackets with the Casa insignia, and how he'd return in the early hours, excited and trembling. She believes these powerful men, doctors, lawyers, executives, and Judge Hayden, were involved in the same activities as Stuart and killed him to keep him quiet. The final pieces fall into place when Delaware confronts Tim Krueger, who reveals under duress that Melody Quinn is being held at La Casa. Krueger confesses that Melody's mother had been murdered by a partially paralyzed man named Earl, who was working on McCaffrey's orders. Earl himself was later killed by another staff member named Halstead. Krueger also reveals the true nature of the Gentleman's Brigade, a cover for child molesters. About a quarter of the gentlemen were pedophiles, carefully mixed among legitimate members. They specifically targeted vulnerable children who couldn't communicate, those who were disabled, non-English speaking, or orphans without family connections. McCaffrey had run a similar operation in Mexico called Father Augustine's Christian Home until it was shut down. Most disturbingly, Krueger explains that Stuart Hickle had been a brigade member who freelanced with children at his wife's school. After getting caught, McCaffrey, Hayden, and Tao feared he would expose their operation. Judge Hayden lured Hickle with false promises of help, then Tao drugged him. They moved his unconscious body to Delaware's office, where they staged his suicide, explaining the traumatic event that had driven Delaware into retirement. These revelations expose the full horror of the conspiracy, a network of powerful men exploiting their positions to abuse vulnerable children, protected by their wealth and connections. The murders of Handler, Gutierrez, Bruno, and Benita Quinn were all committed to protect this operation, with Melody's life in danger because she might have witnessed something incriminating. Most shocking is the connection to Hickel's suicide, revealing that Delaware himself had been unwittingly drawn into the conspiracy years earlier, making his involvement in the current case not coincidental, but part of a pattern of manipulation by these powerful predators. Delaware compels Dr. Towell to assist in Melody's rescue from La Casa through decisive action. During their journey, Tal experiences a psychological episode where his speech becomes incoherent, repeatedly stating, "The ego must maintain integrity." After taking medication, an experimental phenothiazine variant that he describes as making muddy waters turn crystalline, he reveals his struggle with a serious mental health condition. Once stabilized, Tal discloses his connection to McCaffrey's operation while maintaining his distance from direct involvement. He reveals a tragic incident from his college years. While struggling with academic pressure, a confrontation with his wife Lila resulted in a fatal accident. In the aftermath, their young son Willie Jr. was also seriously injured. McCaffrey, working as a maintenance worker, discovered the situation and brought in associates Stuart and Eddie to manage the crisis. They constructed a cover story involving a car accident at Evergreen Bridge. Years later, McCaffrey, now presenting himself as a religious figure with questionable credentials, approached the now successful Dr. Tal to collect on past obligations, establishing a long-term pattern of exploitation. At La Casa, Delaware and Tal locate Melody, who has been sedated and restrained. McCaffrey appears and attempts to orchestrate a situation to implicate Delaware. Through careful questioning, Delaware reveals McCaffrey's decades-long deception. Willie Jr. had survived and been taken to Mexico, where McCaffrey raised him to become the troubled individual known as Earl. Upon realizing Melody's resemblance to Lila, indicating she is his granddaughter, Tal faces a violent confrontation with McCaffrey. The situation escalates until Melody awakens in distress. As McCaffrey threatens her, Delaware intervenes in a physical altercation. Detective Hardy arrives with tactical support, ending the confrontation definitively. This resolution exposes the intricate web of manipulation spanning decades. McCaffrey had exploited Tal's guilt and grief while secretly raising Willie Jr. to participate in criminal activities. The presence of Melody, Tal's granddaughter, represents both the perpetuation of family tragedy and the potential for breaking the cycle of trauma. The intervention of law enforcement brings closure to the conspiracy, though the moral implications remain complex. The narrative reveals how past trauma and manipulation can create generational consequences, while also demonstrating how truth and intervention can ultimately disrupt patterns of exploitation. In the aftermath, Delaware recovers in the hospital with a battered face and wired jaw. Robin initially nurtures him before expressing anger at his reckless risk-taking, though they eventually reconcile. Delaware arranges for Melody to be placed with a childless couple in Bakersfield who have access to a gifted child psychologist he knows from graduate school, ensuring she will receive the care and stability she needs to heal from her trauma. 6 weeks after La Casa's fall, Delaware and Robin meet Milo and his boyfriend Rick for dinner at an elegant Bel Air seafood restaurant. When they have a moment alone, Delaware questions the official story about Judge Hayden's suicide, noting that Hayden was arrogant and narcissistic, not the type to kill himself. Milo admits that after arresting Hayden, he allowed the judge to dress in his study where he found a hidden gun. As Hayden bragged about abusing children and made disgusting insinuations, comparing himself to Milo and calling them both perverts, Milo saw nothing but darkness in the man. Realizing Hayden would likely use his wealth and influence to escape justice, Milo made a decision. He grabbed Hayden's head, jammed the gun in his mouth, and pulled the trigger. "Nighty night, Your Honor," were his final words to the judge. This conclusion addresses the aftermath of trauma and the complex nature of justice. Delaware's arrangement for Melody shows his continued commitment to helping children heal, while his reconciliation with Robin suggests the possibility of personal happiness despite his renewed engagement with darkness. Milo's confession about executing Hayden raises profound questions about justice and morality. Was this vigilantism justified when the legal system would likely have failed? The novel ends without providing easy answers, acknowledging that healing from trauma is possible, while suggesting that true justice remains elusive in a world where power and wealth often shield the guilty from consequences.